Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 167 of season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me on this very, very special episode is Bill Kimberlin, a special effects guy from ILM. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I mean, first of all, it's nice to meet you. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to me.
So let me set the scene for you.
Okay.
So I work for Lucasfilm, and I work for the Industrial Light and Magic Division.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We are located across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco in Marin County.
Mm-hmm.
And George has Skywalker Ranch there, which is a 5,000-acre ranch. But we were too dirty to belong at the ranch. We blew it up. We would blow up a Star Destroyer.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
No, in an industrial, a light industrial area. And by the way, that's where the name Industrial Light and Magic comes from. Because if you look at a zoning map in San Rafael, California, the area we were located in would say zoning, light industrial. So all George had to do was add the name Magic, and he had Industrial Light and Magic. So that's where we did our stuff. And it amounted to about 7 buildings. Initially, it's ILM started in Los Angeles. And after Star Wars was released and was successful, George does not like Los Angeles, especially Hollywood. So we moved the whole operation to Marin County, where he had bought a home, actually bought it from my uncle, who was a banker.
Oh, wow.
And he didn't buy my uncle's home, but my uncle did the deal. And then about 2 years later, Marcia Lucas, George's wife, came in to see my uncle. And she said, "I want to deposit this check." And she handed the check to my uncle. And he said, "Marcia, where did you get all this money?" That was the money from American Graffiti.
Oh, wow.
When he got the Star Wars money, he had the opportunity to buy a ranch out, coincidentally, on a road called Lucas Valley Road.
Was it called that beforehand, so, or he changed the name, or they changed the name because he was there?
No. It happened to be named after a farmer named Lucas, coincidentally. And so he bought the, I believe it was called Bull Tail Ranch, which was about 1,000 acres. Then, as he wanted to add employees, Marin County has a rule that you have to have more property to add more people. So he bought Big Rock Ranch, and then he bought another ranch until he had 5,000 acres.
Wow.
And he built, I remember first going out there probably the second week that I had worked there, and it was the 4th of July big party that they gave for the employees. And we saw something being built over on the other side of the little valley. It's in a little valley. And, you know, it was a bunch of wood framing. And we said, "What's that?" And George says, "Oh, that's going to be my office." Well, it turned out to be a 50,000 square foot building that looks like a hotel.
Wow.
With a veranda and a restaurant and a chef and editing rooms. And then he built a technical building that could house a symphony orchestra playing to a movie screen. and an archive building, etc. And most of the people that came up from Los Angeles to work for ILM or for Lucasfilm in general had the dilemma, since this was the only movie studio there at the time, if you get laid off, which you're constantly laid off and hired back, you can't just walk across town like you could in Los Angeles and go to another studio. So we wound up hiring a lot of people from Marin, and a lot of them turned out to be extremely talented and made up eventually some of the biggest supervisors. I mean, Richard Edlund had been a cable car conductor, and he invented a thing called the pig nose, which, if you're a musician, that's what you plugged your electronic guitar in to when you wanted to practice. So this unusual group of people, somehow I always felt influenced the work, because when talent came to ILM, like we had Paul McCartney there, he would talk to the stagehands, and he actually, one of them said, "Can my friend Mike bring over his your famous album of Abbey Road, crossing Abbey Road with a, a shoe missing?" And he said, "Sure." So he signed my friend Mike's album, and that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been the guy who was the grip on that shoot where they were flying McCartney across the sky in the big studio. He was an Ice Capade champion. His father had been a vaudeville performer, and his father had survived the crash of the Hindenburg because he was an acrobat and he jumped out the window and rolled. So these were some of the people. The guy that did the opening ski stunts for one of the James Bond films worked for me. So it was a really unusual grouping of both Hollywood people and local artists, machinists, welders, and camera people. So that's a little sense of the place that created some of these movies. And obviously, when George was between movies and thinking up the next movie, we were hired out to the other film directors, Steven Spielberg, and a whole raft of filmmakers. And that way, George was able to keep together a talented group of people that he was comfortable around and talking to. When I first worked there, George was a very reticent person. He did not like dealing with people that he didn't know. Once he got to know you, you'd sit next to him at lunch, and we could kibitz back and forth about movies and tell stories just like everybody else. But my friend had worked there for 2 years, and he stuck out his hand one time when George was walking down the D hallway and said, "Hi, my name's Tim, and I've worked for you for 2 years, and I've never met you." And he said George practically jumped backwards. So when it came to doing Saving Private Ryan, the effects, Spielberg later said, became one of the stars of the film. And one of the reasons for that is there were the practical effects. The practical effects were the effects done on the mock-up of D-Day landing, Normandy Beach. The explosions, all of the fake dead bodies, the every thing that could practically be done without going to CG or matte paintings or anything. And they even took the cameras and changed the shutter speed so that you would get this staccato shaking, as if this was real combat footage taken. And my shot was the landing aftermath. So what Steven Spielberg sent us was a VistaVision piece of film that was a crane shot. So the camera is looking at the soldiers coming by and walking by, driving by in Jeeps, and there's the sound effects. And the camera slowly raises up into the air, and now we can see down onto the beach itself. Well, when we got the film, this was VistaVision, which is four times the size of standard 35 millimeter image. And we used that very large format because we were still doing optical compositing. And when you start out with a very large image and you go through so many duplicating processes, you can retain the grain structure and the contrast ratios much more easily. Now, of course, it's a much different deal with everything now. It's all digital captured, digital projection, all the intermediates are digital. But we were still a little, if this was after Jurassic Park, but it was still, we had a couple of feet in analog. So when we got this shot, the beach was empty. There was nothing there except they had put some steel cross members that the Germans had put out to try and keep the landings very difficult. And so everything in that shot was either a matte painting or groupings of soldiers. Spielberg would shoot a group of soldiers marching, and then he would move the group and have them march farther down the beach, and then a farther closer to the sea. And we would then take these and duplicate them, so that it looked like there were hundreds of soldiers
Oh, wow.
instead of bands of eight. So it was patching this together. They also did the same thing with jeeps, tanks, half tracks. All the boats, the ships were a matte painting. And there were balloons that were floating in the air. I think those were put there by the Germans trying to give obstacles for any planes that might fly in and strafe the beach. So when we got done with this, I made up a visual that had the shot as it was sent to us up to the looking down at the D-Day beach, nothing there. And then I dissolved through to coming up again with it partially completed, and then the third time totally completed.
Oh, wow.
So I took this to the University of Indiana and gave a talk there. And I ran this demo piece showing the three levels. And at the little get together after my talk, I got accosted by these history professors, and they kept saying, "Do you realize how dangerous this is?" They thought that we just did spaceships and dinosaurs. They had no idea that we could recreate history. I can't imagine what they think now with what we can do. But at the time, that they just would not stop with me, and I kept saying, "Look, fellows, this is what we do for a living. We make movies. The audience is in on the gag. You know, they know that nobody's being shot. We're faking it. That's what we do." And they wouldn't let it alone. They felt like we were like Leni Riefenstahl, making a movie of the 30s Olympics and modifying it such a way to make the Germans look like heroes. In any case, I thought that
That's
was
amazing.
unusual that they would be so surprised. I mean, it's not like we were making something up. We were recreating what had actually happened in the most dramatic way that we could come up with. And it made a very powerful sequence. No one had ever done anything like that before. So we were a participant in recreating history. I got so interested in what happened there that I did some research after we finished the film. And I found that there was a combat reporter, photographer, a woman named Martha Gellhorn. She happened to be Ernest Hemingway's third wife. And Martha was famous for saying, "I want to be where the bombs are falling." So she got a press pass from Collier's magazine to cover the landing. And when Hemingway found out, he called up Collier's and said, "I'm Ernest Hemingway, and I'd like to cover it for you." And so, because he was so much more famous than her, they gave him her pass.
Oh, wow.
What she did is she flew to Europe and snuck onto a hospital ship and hid in the bathroom, and it set off for the beaches of Normandy. And when she finally revealed herself, it was too late for them to send her back. And so they put her on as a nurse. And she was the only woman to land with 150,000 soldiers on the beach at Normandy. And she was there, covered it, whereas Hemingway, with his credentials, was about a half a mile away on a ship. Because they didn't want the reporters to get killed,
Right.
watching through binoculars. And she wrote it from the beach herself. And I've read both coverages, and hers is better.
Well,
She was
it makes
never
sense.
arrested. She was arrested by the military and put in a sort of concentration camp from which she escaped and went back to Paris. So that little story, I wrote it, I called it 150,000 men and one woman at
Right.
Normandy. So it's a famous event, obviously, but it became real for a lot of Americans through that motion picture. And there's one scene I actually got a photograph of this. It was lifted from the film. And it's where there's a woman who is the mother of these boys that all got killed. And she's washing the dishes and she's looking out the window and she sees this military couple of cars coming up to her farm. And she goes and opens the door, and then when she realizes what this means, she sinks to her knees. And I thought that was one of the most emotionally effective scenes in the entire movie. It brought home what had happened. And of course, the story was there were four or five sons, and they all got killed except for one. A screenwriter found this story, wrote it up about the event, which was sending soldiers in to pull this one brother that was still alive out of the war. And so I was told that after this movie was released, the studio got a tremendous number of phone calls from people who had some association with the landing and the battle. And I know we had a fellow who was a he I think he was actually landed on the beach as a soldier. He was an older man, the father of one of the ILM producers. And he sat in the screening room with us and watched dailies and commented. And then, of course, when they were shooting it with Spielberg on the beach, they also had people there who had participated to make sure they got the details right.
Wow.
And so I think that's one of the reasons that it was so effective, at least as far as that capturing that beach and what they had to go through.
Yeah.
And you know, the Red Badge of Courage, the famous story and then film that I think John Huston directed, is the nearest thing I can think of that really puts you in the boots of guys, and you could see that war is truly hell.
That's the point of this movie.
Yes, exactly.
So you when working on that particular scene, the Met picture of the beach, following the landing and stuff like that, I'm assuming you had a team that was working on it with you. How long does it take to do something like that?
Well, so there was a matte artist working on the painting. One of the things that we, I guess, prided ourselves on was making these scenes look as real as possible. And that meant using all the tricks that an artist uses. In other words, when, for instance, we had a digital dinosaur walking on the main road sequence in Jurassic Park, when he put his foot down, we had water that we shot out on the stage that would splash up real water filmed in at high speed to make it slow down and give it the sense. You need to establish weight. We went out and got elephants and painted crosshatching on them and filmed them, and so that the animators could study the movement. Because as Phil Tippett, who was in charge of the dinosaur wrangling, which was what we called it, he said, you know, these large animals are the closest thing we have to an anthropologic record of what dinosaurs might have looked like, what their skin might have looked like, what when they were stomping along, what would result, you know, a minor camera shake, the splashing water, dust, rain, and using lighting and shadow techniques to make it look as if these creatures are actually very, very heavy. Because otherwise, animated characters like that tend to float. You have to emphasize them with every little artist trick you can think of, a shadow and lighting. Like if you think of painting a car sitting on the side of the road, you got to make those tires look like they're squished a little bit because that car is heavy. And you through these subtleties that the audience does not notice consciously, but they will know that something is wrong when it's done improperly.
Right.
And one of the reasons visual effects has gotten such a bad reputation in later years, all the directors are running around now bragging that they don't use visual effects very much. They don't use CG very much. They always try and get it, real cameras like, the Tom Cruise jet plane movie he did. He was running around saying this was all done with mounted cameras, which of course it wasn't, but a lot of it was, as much as they could get away with. There's been a bit of a backlash, and I always thought that if you do it correctly with either models or with CG, and you approach it like an artist, I mean, the supervisors there, like Dennis Muren, when he was shooting stuff in space, for Star Wars, he would be thinking about, well, where is my camera? Where is my camera mounted? Now, of course, you don't have a camera because you're not in space. You're on a stage surrounded by a bunch of stagehands smoking cigarettes and trying to look useful. But the thinking behind it is what counts, and that's the input of people that are artists and filmmakers. And that's one of the reasons I was hired, is because in visual effects, you tend to concentrate on a frame. In other words, you're a matte painter, you're doing a matte painting, and that is, your life. And you're making it as realistic as possible. And I had made a feature film which had done fairly well. I showed it there. And when we got about 2 minutes into it, somebody shouted out, "Has George seen this?" And I was working there a month or so later. And they supposedly hired me because they wanted somebody that had experience with the whole flow of the thing. You're doing one shot, and your shot is 26 frames long. Well, that's part of a whole sequence of other shots, and it has to hang together. And so we had three categories of shot. We would call them temps, CBBs, or finals. A CBB stood for could be better. We think that the director could cut it into the film and we'd be happy, and he'd be happy. But if we have time, if we don't totally run out of time, we're going to go back and we're going to redo that shot and get it perfect, if we can get it perfect. Now, once George had finaled a shot, it's going in the movie. And one day he had this, there was a shot that was so complicated, it took like 10 hours to composite it. Because in those days, what you're doing is you're taking an element of a spaceship and you're burning it into a piece of negative, and you have all the rest of the spaces matted out so they are not exposed. And the camera person, the camera operator, these optical printers are basically a camera looking at a projector. So you wind the film back and you add the next element, and then wind it back again and add two more elements in it. So it took 10 hours to shoot it. They run it in dailies the next day. George likes it. He finals it. Well, there's a flaw. So the operator decided on his own, "Here, I'm going to redo that shot and I'm going to get it perfect." So it came up in dailies the next day, and George said, "I already finaled this. We're not cutting it to the movie, period." In other words, you have to know when to stop polishing the chrome, because that's one of the things about George that was different than most other directors I ever worked with. George knew how to make a movie, and most directors, Steven Spielberg is a great director, but You could give George 300 pounds of film and send him off, and he could come back with a movie that he shot, that he edited, that he supervised the sound and the mixing for, and you would have a movie and it'd be a damn good one. And not every director could do that. And so what that meant was when he was working on something, he's cognizant of good enough. Let's move on. And when he was not there, he's in England, say, and they're shooting on the stages in England. We're back at ILM and we have all these shots partially done, but we can't tear the sets down because is it a final or not? No one here. So George shows up. The producers are all wringing their hands. And George says, "You want answers? Bring the lights down. Run the film. Bing, bang, boom, final. Temp. Redo it. Don't redo it." So all of a sudden, multi-million dollar decisions are flowing out of this guy. Lights come up. Everybody knows what they have to do or redo or not do or tear the sets down for the things that are final. They're final, they're out the door. And a lot of directors can't do that. They're unsure. They keep changing their mind. They don't really know what they want. And I used to say it was like given a guy at keys to a Ferrari. You better know how to drive a Ferrari or you're going to wind up in a ditch because you're dealing with powerful effects people here that can do a lot of stuff. And it's fear and it's understandable. Some people are comfortable with it. Many get, as they go along, they get better and better at it, the more films they make. And the big thing that we had was we guaranteed our work. In other words, the seats are sold. The movie's coming out. I remember George getting up one day. He said, "This movie, this was a Return of the Jedi. This movie's coming out May 25th or whatever it was. And I don't care if there's work print in it. The movie is coming out." And that was just like we got the message. We better get this thing done. Because you don't want to disappoint every little kid in the world. Can you imagine how many little kids saw these movies? I once went into the business office and I saw a list of everywhere the movie was going to play. Well, every country in the world, then every state or territory in every country in the world, then every city in the world. And then every movie theater in that city. Now, that's a lot of
Yeah,
screens,
completely.
And so that's why if you spend $100 million building the Bank of America in downtown San Francisco, it might take you 10 or 15 years to get your money back. If you make a blockbuster motion picture, you could get your 100 million back. And change in 3 months.
Wow.
It is the fastest return of capital in capitalism.
Yeah.
The only thing that comes close is like, Harry Potter. George made his billions selling movie tickets. He not like Silicon Valley. Every other guy in Silicon Valley goes public, raises a huge amount of money. George never took. But George made his movie by sell his money by selling movie tickets. He is not someone who raised public money for anything. All his money was made by raising capital from bank loans and making good deals
Yeah, because he
where
wanted to create a control, which makes sense.
exactly. And I swear there were two or three times where he would have been replaced if he didn't own the company. There's no question. I mean, replace Steve Jobs, they could replace George Lucas, but not if you own the company.
Right.
And but you're sticking your neck out financially in ways that are pretty scary, because at one point in making of The Empire Strikes Back, the banks said they would not extend him any further loans because, quote, sequels don't make money. So fortunately, he had enough toy sales money that he could finish it himself. And no, Spielberg doesn't do this. Nobody does this. It's like Warren Buffett, who's never split his stock. No one does that. No one does it. But it
Right.
means he can't take over his company because you can't buy enough $300,000 shares to get control of anything.
Right.
So, as I mentioned before, the Harry Potter lady, has done something similar. She's made her fortune by selling books and movies. And that's very impressive because everybody today raises public money for everything. And then they either go on to glory or they go broke.
One or the other.
So George is building a $1 billion museum in Los Angeles. And most people that you hire to run museums spend their entire life raising money. Whoever is running this place is not going to have to raise any money. The
Wow.
money is there already. And it looks like a giant spaceship. I don't know if you've seen pictures of this thing.
I
It's
think
pretty,
I've seen pictures. Yeah.
they're conceptual drawings, and
Right.
COVID threw it into a tizzy. It was supposed to be done by now. But COVID threw everything into a tizzy. So it'll be
Right.
done probably next year, sometime late next year is my guess.
Oh,
I think we've talked about other movies enough to suggest that everything in Hollywood has changed dramatically
yeah.
after Hollywood was convinced they need to go digital.
Right.
And the one director who has not gone digital, I think there's more than one, but Quentin Tarantino, he said, I didn't sign up for this digital stuff. And he had theater, it's called the New Beverly in Los Angeles, and he only runs 35 millimeter prints. So they got hold of me and said, we're going to run your movie. And I said, well, where did you get a 35 millimeter print? This is my film that I made a
Right,
number of years ago.
American Nitro.
American Nitro, yeah. It's a race car film. And he said, well, Quentin found a collector in South Africa and bought a print from him, and we're going to be running it next week or whatever. And so I said, well, that's interesting. That shows how crooked my distributor was, because what they were doing was they were, these are prints that I purchased, basically. Because I had made the film and put up all the money for it, and then I got a distribution deal. I knew these guys were crooks, but they were crooks with a pipeline all the way to South Africa. So I was able to get my film out there. So what they had done is they would sell the print to a local guy and say, here, give us $5,000. We'll give you this print. You can run it till it wears out and see how much money you can make.
Oh, wow.
Some collector got hold of it, and I've got a print of it. But anyway, that's how I got noticed, so that I could work for Lucasfilm. I started out making documentaries, and I I always thought if I could just work somewhere in the movie business and still be able to make my own films, I'd be a happy camper. And I did that for quite a while. But then, this was an unusual job to pass up, and I couldn't see doing that. And then I wrote a book about this experience
Inside the Star
inside the
Wars
Star
Empire.
Empire, the memoir. And on the back of it, there's a picture from Back to the Future. And Spielberg made this statement, and I put it on the back of the book. I always thought that if ILM had ever run the space agency, we had would have colonized Mars by now. So it was one of the most organized places on the face of the earth. I mean, every day we would have dailies, which would show the material we had shot the day before, or it was material from like when we did Return of the Jedi. It had come in from the Redwood Forest up in Humboldt County, which is Northern California, way north, from the redwood trees where they had the bike
Right, for
chase.
Endor. Right.
Yeah, so they filmed the backgrounds there. And the way they did that was, they took a Steadicam through the forest, and we got tons and tons of footage coming back. And one day you see this footage, and then some Ewoks come into the frame holding a big sign that says "Happy Birthday, George." And so he kept saying, "Run this at the house tonight because I want Marcia to see it." So Marcia was his right-hand person, and Marcia, we were all very sad to see her leave. She had cut Taxi Driver. She had cut Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. I mean, she was a major figure. And the thing I always say about her is she could not only tell you what was wrong with your movie, she could tell you how to fix it.
Oh, wow.
And that's gold.
Yeah, for sure.
So when Steven Spielberg ran Raiders of the Lost Ark for his buddies, including George and a bunch of other directors and Marsha, at the end, Marsha said, "Steven, there's no emotional resolution to the movie. We don't know what happened to Indy and the girl." So he said, "Oh my God," and went out and reshot the ending so that and they shot it in this on the
On the steps,
steps
right?
to San Francisco, where they meet up, and we get a sense that they have made their decisions about the future. And that did it. That sold it. And I remember Marcia came in to do 2 weeks on Return of the Jedi. And I talked to one of the assistant editors, and she said she was pulling scraps out of a trim bin and putting together a scene. And this is the scene where the Ewok are on the log, and they're having a back and forth with Princess Leia. And she just wrings emotion out of that scene from God knows where. There's like almost no conversation. It's like some squeaks, but you get this sense of building an emotional scene from nothing. And so not we just thought that the combo was right between them. She would come in and do some work or make comments. And Hitchcock had a wife like this too. She was an editor, and when she said something, he listened. And you wouldn't think he'd listen to anybody, but he listened to her. And I always see whenever I see a movie from a director, a well-known director that I've liked his works and everybody else has, and then there's a clunker. You know, there's always a clunker. But I often wonder is, well, was he not working with the team he normally works with? You know, because I remember on Gangs of New York, Scorsese lost his writer, the screenwriter. You know, the shoot went on so long, and he wanted to do some other shoots, and they had a temporary guy come in. But boy, when that writer came back and that those two got together, all of a sudden you had a scene. I remember the scene. So I worked on this Gangs of New York. And so there's a scene where the guy is on a streetcar and this girl brushes up against him and steals his wallet or something. And then he sort of chases her down the street and confronts her. She pulls a switchblade on him, puts it up to his throat. He wrestles it away from her. And then he says, "You want to go out?" I thought that was such a great line. You know, all this tension and all this tracking her down and everything. And, you know, that's a movie scene. And this guy, you know, came up with that. And it was DiCaprio, and I don't
Was
know who the
Cameron Diaz, wasn't it?
and that could be, you know, I worked on The Mask, and Cameron Diaz was there with her co-star Jim Carrey. Well, we all thought that Cameron was the director's girlfriend because she came from nowhere and she had been a model. He saw her picture on the front of a magazine, hired her. And nobody, Jim Carrey, nobody knew who he was. He had shot two films that they'd not been released. And so I would go out to the stage and watch them work. And Carrey was a mimic. And he started mimicking our producer, who was kind of a jerk. And he had him just absolutely perfect. I don't know how he did it. But he just became that guy for, you know, half a minute or something. And so it was fun to be able to hang around and see what these actors could do. Like I worked on Cocoon, and the couple there would be standing, let's see, who were the older couple? I can't think of their
Wilford
names right
Brimley
now.
and I'm tipping my tongue.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, Wilford was really good in that, but there was a couple there who were married.
Maureen Stapleton. No?
No. No.
You have Donna Meachie was
Anyway.
also there, Hume Cronyn.
Yeah, right. Cronin. And
And
his
Jessica
Hugh
Tandy.
Cronin and his
Jessica Tandy.
wife, Jessica. Okay, so the two are there, you know, standing by the craft table or something, talking, and then Ron Howard would say, "Okay, we're ready. The lighting's ready," or something. They would just walk over casually into the set and just pick up from where they left off, like
Wow.
magic. And that was really fun to see that. And of course, there's a big difference with actors and actresses who have been trained on the stage and those that are film actors primarily. You know, it's a different ballpark, but some of them can pass through one thing just as easily as the other. And for some reason, comedians seem to really make great bad guys, you know, like Jerry Lewis, when he played the character who gets kidnapped. And then, of course, Lewis became a noted film director in his own right. And he wrote a great book about directing that really educated me. And Ron Howard was like that too. Not that many actors can convert themselves into directors, but Ron Howard was certainly one. And I remember when he, after he directed a pretty big film, Cocoon, yeah. After he directed Cocoon, he's the, by the way, the nicest, smartest guy you're ever going to want to meet. And he came in and, "Where's George?" he says. He came into editorial. And, you know, he had, of course, been one of the stars of American Graffiti. And here he was back as a major now film director in his own right. And I thought that must be quite a sensation to go from actor to director. I know he used to say to George during American Graffiti, he would say, "George, just tell us what we want. You want. We're actors. We can do anything." You know? And I thought, it's because George famously is a director who said, you know, faster or do it again. Very little information. Now, of course, John Huston used to say, "After I cast these people, I can't tell them anything. They're so good. I just say, you know, cut and action." And I can understand that. You know, what are you going to say to some of these guys? What are you going to say to Clint Eastwood? Or what are you going to say to Jack Nicholson? You know, they're going to come up with something you didn't think of.
Wow. It sounds like you've had an amazing career. You got to meet a lot of interesting people, got to work on some great
I guess,
movies.
Well, I had made my own films. I knew, you know, what the game was about, how difficult it is. And anybody that ever came up to me, I taught film for a while, and wanted help, I was there because I know how difficult it is to make your own movie. It's really tough. And I have a friend who has been an artist filmmaker his entire life, has been broke his entire life, but he wrote a best-selling book called Feature Filmmaking at Used Car Prices. And that thing sold over 100,000
Wow.
copies. And he helped me get my agent, who was his agent, for my book, because it's really difficult to publish a book unless you are already famous. And but I had a lot of experiences that to me were worth recounting because I was there and I wrote it down. And I'm the only guy that has ever written a book out of the Lucasfilm Empire. There have been some picture books and all, but nothing by the employees.
Did you
And
have to
so
get special permission
I,
from Lucasfilm to do it?
well, it, there's a story behind that. But this photo right here is SB19. Okay, SB19 is the 19th shot in the space
Okay.
battle in Return of the Jedi. And that was my sequence, and that was my shot. This shot is the most complicated shot ever composited optically, and it's
Wow.
one of the last, and it will never be done again, clearly. But so they told me that I could include any photos that were from the productions at ILM, because ILM photographers took those photos and they belong to ILM. Otherwise, you'd get all
Right.
tied up with the studios. So at a given point, I had to get permission to use that photo because they had changed. By now, Disney owned Lucasfilms, and Disney said, okay, we've got a new set of rules. You cannot use any images from the movies. You can use them from ILM, but not from Star Wars movies. And I said, but you don't understand. That's not from the movie. That was made by the photo department. They put all those ships together from the original ships against blue screen. They recomposited it as a still for promotional purposes. And fortunately, I knew my friend, the broke filmmaker, Rick. His daughter was John Lasseter's right-hand person. And so I called her up and I said, you know, this is my situation. Can you help me out? And she said, I'll call you back. So I'm having breakfast at Saul's in Berkeley. It's a Jewish delicatessen. And as I'm walking out the door, the phone rings, and it's the head of publicity for Lucasfilm. Oh, hi, Bill. We're so happy you're doing a book, and it'll help us too. And, you know, all of a sudden, no's became yeses because you didn't want to piss off John Lasseter because he had made $5
Right.
billion Pixar movies in
True.
a row. And so the lawyers then relented and said, yeah, you can use this for the cover. I was sweating bullets because I wanted to use that as the. And so consequently, everybody thinks the book is only about Star Wars, and it is about the
Is Lucas? I was
Empire
gonna say the
is
Empire
Lucasfilm.
is for sure Lucasfilm.
Right. The Empire is not Star Wars Empire. So the diehard fans, when they found it was not all about Star Wars, and I didn't personally know the Princess Leia actress, they are not as interested. But it turns out Hollywood is kind of interested. Tarantino watched my movie, American Nitro, and then they had a whole, and he somehow read my book. And so I got a lot of nice
That's
comments
great.
on that from him. And his podcasts go all over the world. So I was selling DVDs of Nitro, hand over fist. And then occasionally I go to some of these Star Wars, not conventions, but a speaking engagement I'll get invited to. And I can sell a bunch of books there. And it's still in print. So if anybody wants to. I think if you want to be involved with the movie business or entertainment in general, it'll help you to read this book. Because, you know, I did not come from a motion picture family. When I was a little boy, I lived with my great aunt for a while, and she had a next door neighbor. This is in Marin County, and her name was Mrs. Hickman. Well, I was always taking stuff over to Mrs. Hickman that my great aunt wanted her to have, like soup or sandwiches or something. Well, every time I went into her apartment, the television was on 24/7 at full volume. So I said to my aunt, what is going on there? And she said, oh, you're too young to remember. But that's Bessie Barriscale. And she was one of the biggest silent screen stars in America for about a decade. And her husband was a movie director. And so I later found out, yeah, she knew Mary Pickford. She knew everybody. And she had worked for D.W. Griffith. And in those days, there was no TV guide. There was no listing of what they were going to show on television in the newspaper. And they used old movies as filler rather than run a test pattern. And so they had dozens of movies, silent movies, sound movies, and they would run them randomly. So that's why she kept the TV on all the
And
time, because she could
she
see
didn't
her
know when it would be on.
old films. And there were no revival houses. There were no revival houses. There was no way, there was no videotape or DVD. There was no place to see these. I mean, you could go to a college town and maybe, but she was in her 80s. And she could see her husband's films that he directed, the films that she was in, and all of her Hollywood buddies. So I looked it up when I got to film school, and it was all true. She had done all these things. And the other experience I had was my mother took me to the set of a film called Blood Alley, starring Lauren Bacall and John Wayne. And so there's a little Chinese fishing village, shrimping village, in Marin on the bay, and it's long since gone now, but the buildings were all there. And so the movie decided that they were going to shoot this as if it was in China, because it certainly looked like a Chinese fishing village. And so we went down to visit the set. And as I was walking into the set, there was a giant stack of boulders to one side, and I bumped the boulders with my shoulder, and they moved. I thought, wait, how could they move? Oh, I get it. They're fake. And there are adults that work in movie businesses, and this is what they do for a living. How cool is that? That was the other. And then it turns out ILM was about 2 miles from there, where, 30 years later, I wound up working for 20 years. Those were the kind of experiences, the only kind of experiences that I had that tipped me off to, yeah, there are people who work in movies. And when I meet a young person, I was in a cafe the other day, and I said to the lady behind the counter, I said, are you going to college? She said, yeah, but I don't know what I want to do, and I can't decide. And I said, how about motion pictures? And I thought she was going to like keel over, because no one would ever say that to her. But I tell young people, if you want to work in movies, you can do it. It's not impossible. You can, first off, get an internship if you can. We had them at Lucasfilm all the time, young, bright kids from all over the world. And then you'll decide whether you like it or not. There's no skin off your nose, because you're expected to just be there 6 weeks, and in the summer you get a stipend, and in the winter you get a class credit for what you've done. And it works for any field. I mean, if you think you want to be a lawyer, go check that out, because the lawyers are the most unhappy people when they find out what the job is actually going to be.
That's great.
So, and you'll have to move to Los Angeles, and you'll have to, bump along. And it's really tough now because of the changes that movies are going through, and the theaters sh shutting down, and all that transition that we're in right now. So it's hard to recommend it. But to me, when I did it, it was like one of the last things. One of the last bold artistic adventures you could go on, because you were on your own. But if you could come up with a movie after Easy Rider was released and was a huge hit, the studios couldn't afford not to look at your movie, because you might be the next somebody. And so I showed my film to every major studio in Los Angeles, and was in the DeVille Film Festival and the Long Los Angeles Film Festival, and eventually I picked up a distributor, and so and then I wound up getting the rights back to my film. Nobody gets the rights back to the You have to own
Right.
your film to get it back. But I was, so I've been distributing it myself for the last, 15 years. It's in the Library of Congress, but it's in the Academy Motion Picture archives. And those were founded by Mary
Right.
Pickford, because Charlie Chaplin and all these other guys, Buster Keaton, they weren't interested in last week's movie. It was like last week's
Right.
newspaper to them. But she was smart enough to realize, no, this is our legacy. And so my film negatives are with the Academy Archive, and all of the archive doors have a name of one of Mary Pickford's films over the door, which I think is pretty cool. It was quite a I got a tour of the place. It was amazing.
Wow.
It's our film legacy, and I encourage any other filmmakers I know to deposit them there, because they will take your films.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, Bill, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today. This has been so fascinating. I really appreciate it. And I know everyone listening is also going to be very happy to hear about everything that you've done, both with Saving Private Ryan and with other movies. So thank you very much for joining me for this.
Thanks for having me.
Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. All right, I will be back tomorrow with a new guest, but until then, earn this.
My solitude, you.